So how's everyone doing today? Managed to escape the cold and rain? I didn't. Venables up at Sunti, you're looking very well wrapped up. I took a wrong turn off the train down in Wollstonecraft, and that went over the, there's a bridge over the, is it the Berry Creek or something like that? Amazing. I can't believe I've been coming to this area for such a long time and I've never seen such an incredible thing. Yeah. Anyway, that's always the advantage in taking a wrong turn. If you take the way that you know, then you never learn anything. Anyway, okay, so we're going to do some chanting. Do we have chanting sheets? Do we? That's an excellent confluence of events. We're going to do chanting and we have chanting sheets. Excellent. Right? It's almost like the universe like is working that to be together. I actually need to apologize. I said that we're experiencing it's cold and wet in Sydney today. I feel like on reflection that was very insensitive to any of our friends online who are coming in from England. I do give you my apologies for that. Okay, moving along. Let us begin.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami, dhammam saranam gacchami, sangham saranam gacchami, tutiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami. Iti piso bhagava arahaṁ sammā sambuddho vijja karana sampanno sugato lokayu anuttaro purisacadam sarathi sattā deva manusanam Bhagavati Svakato Bhagavata Namo Sannitiko Akariko Ehipasiko Kamaiko Pachatam Veditabo Subhadhyanno bhagavato sarvasambuddho Ujjupadhyanno bhagavato sarvasambuddho Nayaratipanno bhagavato savakasambho Sanishchitipanno bhagavato savakasambho Yaridam chatari purisadudani Antavisadudana Esa bhagavato samakasambho Ahuneyo, ahuneyo, natineyo, anjai karanyo Anutatana unya ketam lokasati
So when and when the Buddha was talking about mindfulness in meditation in the suttas, typically he the practice of mindfulness is associated with a number of other terms or ideas. I'm just going to briefly mention those other terms and ideas because each of them has something to say about the practice of mindfulness. First thing. We say mindfulness, we say satipatthana, okay? This is the establishing of mindfulness. So the word satipatthana is sati, mindfulness, recollection, remembering, and upatthana. Upatthana literally means to stand near, okay? It's a literal meaning. And its idiomatic usage comes, or there is that word and similar words are used before the time of the Buddha to stand near, especially in the sense of standing near the ritual. So you would be performing a fire ritual or something like that, and you would be serving or attending that fire ritual. In other words, standing near to your God, right? So it has that sense of just like, just standing near something, but it also has like a religious and uplifting sense to it. But to stand near is also to care for. So the same word, the same root, is also used for a nurse or a carer, somebody who stands near or is close by or who attends on someone. So these are some of the connotations of the word mindfulness. So when we say to establish mindfulness, to care for mindfulness, right, to attend to mindfulness, right? So there's a kind of a nice like emotional connotation to that, right? It's not purely just a like setting something up, but it's about attending and taking care of something. Another word we use in that context is the word parimukhang. Parimukhang satingo patapetwa. Parimukhang is a slightly obscure term, but the basic meaning seems to be present or in the presence. So parimukhang means to attend to what is present, to bring your attention to what is present. Now, that also has an emotional sense to it, because like a lot of the time we get distanced from what is present and we become attached to, you know, what has been the past, what has been in the future, what is somewhere else, what somebody else has done. But to bring attention, to stand close to attend to care for what is present. And so this is telling us something about the quality of mind that we bring to the meditation. Yeah? So these words that the Buddha is using in this context are very carefully chosen. This is the style of the Buddha in the suttas. He chose his words extremely carefully, and they always reward like a deeper reflection. So some of the other words which we find associated with mindfulness, ātāpi is one. Ātāpi, ātāpi, ardent, zealous, energetic, relentless, okay, keeping on going, almost like fervent. Yeah? Has a root sense like to be on fire, right? So this is about applying energy. When you're doing mindfulness, it's not a lazy practice, okay? Much as I admire laziness, I think laziness is one of the most underappreciated qualities that there is, okay? I'm just going to give a bit of a detour here. And Masanobu Fukuoka, the great Zen philosopher of farming, used to write about how everybody was out on their farms and their fields, plowing the earth, churning it up, destroying everything, whereas plants actually just want to grow. And just to be, to allow things to give them the time to grow is like really important. So as far as I'm aware, generally speaking, wars aren't started by people who couldn't be bothered getting out of bed in the morning. Typically, wars are started by people who got out of bed in the morning. So if you're ever lying in bed and you're too lazy and you're not going to get up, you just think to yourself, at least I'm not starting a war. Right? Could be worse. Could be worse. So, but anyway, when we're practicing meditation, then don't take my advice, take the Buddha's advice. And so we are energetic and keen. Atapi. Sampajano is another word that's associated with mindfulness. Sampajano also is, it means to be one who has sampajanya, which means situational awareness. Situational awareness means you're aware of the context, you're aware of the purpose, you're aware of why you are here and why you are doing what it is that you're doing, and what is going on around you, all right? So this is the sampajanya or situational awareness. Atapi sampajano satima, that means possessed of mindfulness, and vinaya loke abhijja domana sang is the last phrase there. Vinaya loke abhijja domana sang means, so abhijja domana, abhijja means covetousness, and domana means, in this context, means like negativity, basically. So what this is referring to is the fact that we caught up in liking and disliking things in the world, right? We want this, we don't want that. We're depressed if we don't get what we want. We get caught up in sort of, if only I could get this, if only I could get that. Seeing what somebody else has, wanting to get what somebody else has, all of these things. And so in order to do mindfulness meditation, we have to be able to let go of this. And this is referring to the practice of sense restraint. So through sense restraint, we are able to quieten down these feelings of covetousness and displeasure, or I can't remember how I translated that, in our practice. Now, obviously, not easy to do. And we live in a world where we have a lot of demands on our senses and where sensual distractions are more apparent than ever before, okay? One thing to bear in mind is that these things are always intentional, okay? So if you feel like, I haven't really succeeded, if you feel like you get caught up in something, if you feel like you get distracted by something or whatever, just remember that that your intention to restrain yourself is what is most important. It's not everybody can live in a mountain on top of the Himalayas where your mind is going to be peaceful naturally, or let's say on a mountain in Bundanoon where your mind is going to be naturally peaceful because of your surroundings. Huh? But where we are, if you're living in Sydney, you have a lot more distractions, but the intention to restrain yourself becomes all the more powerful because of that. So don't be too worried if you're getting too distracted and so on. I mean, we all try to do our better and try to do best. But keep in mind that the mindfulness that you hold within yourself is the key, and not getting distracted with those external things. All right. So these are some of the qualities which are associated with mindfulness, and particularly with the practice of mindfulness meditation. Let's do some mindfulness of breathing, and let's see if we can notice those qualities. So sitting quietly. Letting the mind settle back into your body. And bringing attention to the gentle feeling of the breath as it comes in and the breath as it goes out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. and feeling that soft energy of the breath settle down through your limbs. Delicately observing that feather soft breath, just delicately brushing as it comes in and goes out. Like a scrap of the finest silk. Okay, so now coming near to the end of the meditation. Bring mind back into the senses. And before finishing, reflect back over the meditation, inquiring into cause and effect. What just happened? How did my mind change? Finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, so let's have a break for 10 minutes. Grab a cup of tea. Come back for some Dhamma talk. All right, let's ring the bell. Okay, so folks online, good to see you, Pranav, good to see you, Brian and Casey, how's it going? Marion and the other Marion. Justin, Janani. So, Janani, good to see you. Seems that it was too cold for you to come out to Crow's Nest this evening, right?
Cold Prante. Still well, some cold. I didn't want to give it to anybody.
Anyway, no problems. Okay, so for this evening, I'd like to spend some time reading a few short suttas, a few extracts from suttas. Is that okay? We can talk about them on the topic of mindfulness? Yes, okay, good. First of all, let's just do some basic survey on this, some basic summary of this, of what exactly that we're doing, because I know that reading the suttas can be quite intimidating for people because there are a lot of them. In fact, Christelle has just asked online, how many suttas are there? Christelle, I hate to disappoint you, but nobody knows. It's not really countable because they kind of get into this, you have like suttas like this, right, where you see there's an actual text and there's like a couple of pages and so on. That's not a problem. But then a little bit later on, you have things like, sorry, I'm gonna put my glasses on. Okay, so a bit later on, you have things like this, which just gives you like a set of abbreviations and then tells you you should expand it all like that. So this is like a compression algorithm. Right, so you have page after page of these things where it's just giving you like a hint and then telling you that somehow you've got to expand it all out from that. And it's not always entirely clear exactly how they're supposed to be expanded and so on and so forth. So to count the actual number of suttas is a little bit tricky, in fact, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say that if we talk in terms of like proper actual existing suttas, probably around 2,000 or so. So there's 34 in the long discourses and 152 in the Majjhima, and then throughout the other collections, many shorter suttas. Okay, so briefly, a survey of how we do this. Okay, first of all, the Buddhist scriptures we call the Tripitaka, means three baskets. And the tri in Sanskrit is three in English, ti in Pali. And the three are the Vinaya, which is the monastic conduct, guide for monastic conduct, the suttas, which is the discourses, and the Abhidhamma, which is the treatise. Okay. Now, for most of you, you're not going to have to worry about the Vinaya too much. You can read Vinaya if you like. It's very fun. Some bits of it are fun. And the Abhidhamma also is for more kind of advanced study and so on. So the main thing you're going to want to focus on is the suttas, okay? So the discourses is where the main records of the Buddha's teachings are. So in the suttas, we have five nikayas, okay? So the three, Tripitaka, middle one is the suttas, and of them, the five nikayas. Now, those five nikayas, the long discourses, middle discourses, linked discourses, and numerical discourses, sometimes translated a bit differently, but that's how I translate them. Linked long Digha Nikaya, middle Majjhima Nikaya, linked Samyutta Nikaya, numerical, and Guttara Nikaya. And in addition to that, we have a miscellaneous collection called the Kuddhika Nikaya, mostly consisting of poetry and other books. So that's the Kuddhika Ummayana collection. Now, I'm talking here about the Pali canon, so this is the text as passed down through the Theravadan tradition, but the same basic pattern of scriptures was through all schools of Buddhism. And while you don't find an entire collection in that same clean way that you find in Pali, but you do find almost all of those bits and pieces, especially in Chinese translation, also to some degree in Tibetan and Sanskrit and so on. So they have like all of these four agamas and so on. So again, the long, middle, linked, and numerical, and the Kuddhika or minor collection. That's the five Nikaya. So again, remember the Tripitaka, three baskets. Middle one is the suttas. Sutta consists of five Nikayas. So today we're going to be reading from the linked discourses. Long, middle, and linked, the third collection. That's the Samyutta Nikaya. Okay, so here's the Samyutta Nikaya. Samyutta Nikaya consists of, again, five parts. I'm not going to enumerate all the parts, but this one we're looking at is the final one of those parts, which is to do with the path. Okay, so when we print these, this consists of five books. Okay, so five books, and this is the final one of those five books, and that's what it looks like here. Okay, so that's one of the books, one of the five books of the Kuddhika Nikaya, which is one of the five Nikayas, which is the suttas, which is one of the three pitikas. There's 28 in our printing for Sutta Central. There's 28 books, but that's not the whole Tripitaka. That's only the main suttas and Vinaya. It doesn't include the Abhidhamma and doesn't include all of the Kuddhika Nikaya. All right, so today I'm going to read a few suttas from the Samyutta Nikaya, specifically from the collection on mindfulness. So the Samyutta Nikaya is organized by topic, mostly by topic. So the main topics of the Dhamma, like dependent origination, Four Noble Truths, Five Aggregates, Six Senses, and so on, all of them have a special section in the Samyutta Nikaya. Mindfulness is one of those, or the four Satipatthanas. So I'm going to be reading a few short passages from that today. Any questions before we go on? Yeah. Means they're linked to each other, connected, that they are all thematically coherent. Yeah, usually organized by subject matter, but sometimes also by person, like the kind of, all sort of about the same kind of person or the same individual and so on. So there's like a thematic unity to each one. Yeah.
Is there a short discourses?
Is there a short discourse, says Eng Kong, hopefully. okay, well, what I would suggest is that for people who are interested in learning the suttas, there's a really good resource on the web called Reading Faithfully. And maybe, Venerable Pasanna, if you have, if you can, you could throw the link in there for Reading Faithfully. And that's a great website run by a friend of ours called Venerable Kemaratna. And he's done such a good job of putting together resources to help people to get started and develop a practice of reading suttas. And so you can get like a sutta a day in your email or whatever you want. And there's different ways that he's given to help people there. So that's Reading Faithfully, highly recommended if you want to. Thanks very much, Venerable. If you want to get started with the practice of reading the suttas. Okay. So today we're going to be reading from the Satipatthana Samyutta, the collected discourses on mindfulness meditation, and we're going to be looking at just a few parables. So in the suttas, for the most part in the suttas, we don't find a lot of narrative, like there's not a lot of storytelling in most of the suttas, but occasionally we find some of these smaller narratives, and particularly the Satipatthana Samyutta, the collected discourses on mindfulness meditation, that we have a few of these parables. It's a kind of a quirk of this particular collection. I'm going to read a few of those parables and we can maybe discuss them. Okay. So the first one is the hawk. Once upon a time, mendicants, a hawk suddenly swooped down and grabbed a quail. And as the quail was being carried off, he wailed, "I'm so unlucky, so unfortunate to have roamed out of my territory into the domain of others. If today I had roamed within my own territory, the domain of my fathers, this hawk wouldn't have been able to beat me in a fight." And the hawk said, "So, quail, what is your own territory, the domain of your fathers?" And the quail replied, "It's a ploughed field covered with clods of earth." Confident in her own strength, the hawk was not daunted or intimidated. She released the quail, saying, "Go now, quail, but even there you won't escape me." Then the quail went to a ploughed field covered with clods of earth. He climbed up onto a big clod, and standing there, he said to the hawk, "Come and get me, hawk, come and get me, hawk." Confident in her own strength, the hawk was not daunted or intimidated. She folded her wings and suddenly swooped down on the quail. When the quail knew that the hawk was nearly there, he slipped under that clod, but the hawk crashed chest first right there. That's what happens when you roam out of your territory into the domain of others. So, mendicants, don't roam out of your territory into the domain of others. If you roam out of your own territory into the domain of others, Mara will find an opportunity and get hold of you. And what is a mendicant's, not a mendicant's own territory? It's the five kinds of sensual stimulation: sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and touches, which are likable, desirable, and arousing. And what is your own territory? It is the four kinds of mindfulness meditation, meditating on body, feelings, mind, and principles. This is your own territory, the domain of the fathers. So this is the first of the parables. Okay, so I'm just going to notice a few details about this. First of all, obviously we have a nice short sutta. It has some nice kind of humorous elements. You can see that even within this little discourse, right, that it uses those kinds of elements of storytelling, right? Surprise, and sort of has a kind of David and Goliath sort of battle that's set up. We're all kind of rooting for the quail, right? It's actually like it's a very short parable, but it's very skillfully set up so that you get engaged with that, and then, you know, we can recognize the characters, right? The arrogant hawk thinks that he's going to win and so on, or thinks that she's going to win and so on. And a reminder of the importance of staying inside your own domain, right? So when we are meditating and when we're practicing in here, we are aware of what is going on here, and this is what keeps us safe. And whatever's going on in the world out there, yeah, can lead us astray or whatever, but when we remember what our own domain is, then we will be kept safe. So this is the first of those parables. Any questions about that? Alex.
SN47.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, it's an unusual characteristic of this collection, yeah. So in the suttas, you find similes, right, which can be like a very short narrative, sometimes a few longer narratives, but this use of parables like this is quite distinctive of the Satipatthana Samyutta. Honestly, I don't really know why this particular collection, but yeah. Often these parables will have longer versions as well, so there might be a Jataka which tells it in longer version, yeah. Okay.
Because it said like the text said like it's like your ancestors want like the same space to dwell.
Right.
I think Brahmaviharas has like a similar connotation.
Right. Yeah. So the Brahmaviharas has a similar connotation of keeping you safe, right? Because you're not creating enmity with any being, yeah. I mean, it's interesting that in this particular one the quail wasn't so much like concerned with not being the enemy of the hawk. But it's more like, I can beat you if I can. Yeah. Yeah, Kat.
Is there any kind of like symbolism with the hawk and the quail? I wonder whether it sort of have a particular meaning in ancient India.
So the question is there a particular symbolism with the hawk and the quail? Quite possibly, yeah. They like animals in stories often take on personas, right? In some cases those personas are very obvious, right? Like the jackal, for example, is usually like a mean-spirited character and a fool and so on. The lion is brave and noble and things like this. Quail and the hawk, you'd probably want to have a look into that, see how they're used in mythology and so on, yeah.
Because there's the
right,
protection.
That's the quail protection.
What is the
linkage in both cases, they're very vulnerable. Right? The quail is a very small, very fragile, very vulnerable little bird. Yeah.
But why was there chanting about because
the quail was the smallest and the most vulnerable of animals, but when the fire was coming along, then they did an asseveration of truth, and because of that, their fire was diverted. So even the smallest creature still has that power through the power of truth. Yeah.
I'm seeking clarification on this tradition. So I understand that, you know, the Hindu canon had an impact on the Buddhist, Theravada canon.
Sure.
And you had the ancient tales of the Panchatantra, again, that's how you pronounce it, the discourse, the five
Panchatantra, yeah.
Wisdom, which is all about different animals and their fables.
Right. Yeah.
That's influencing Aesop's fables and so forth. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, these were initially meant to be narrated to children at first. And maybe some of these fables would develop to be taught to younger, like, novices who were
maybe, yeah,
supporters. And also it was just a way of remembering wisdom because it was largely an orally transmitted society at first.
Yeah.
So
the point is made that there's, the Buddhist storyteller tradition largely overlaps with the Brahmanical or Vedic story tradition, also Jain. I mean, these are part of the culture, right? And so Panchatantra is one of the collections which contains stories of animals. I'm not that familiar with the Panchatantra as such, but yeah, that you could probably have a look in there and see, you know, whether there are comparable stories there. Whether these were originally meant as children's tales, look, stories are very manifold and they're used in all kinds of different ways. And so it's difficult to, they certainly can be used as children's stories, but whether, I remember when we were out in the desert and we were being taken around and told the stories of the landscape by one of the members of the community there. And he explained that, like, their stories always remain the same, but they're taught to you again and again through your life in different ways so that you're revealing different levels of depth within the story. So, yes, they would have been absolutely used for children's education, but I'm not sure if they would have only been used for children's education. Yeah. Nilushi, yeah. The dhammas, mandalas of the hindrances, the seven awakening factors and the four noble truths. Yeah, so I've talked about the Satipatthanas many occasions, but on the series of talks I did at the beginning of the year, I talked about these things in more detail. So if you want to go back and revise, do your homework with that, Nilushi. You can. Yes.
I would say it's the story,
half is missing. The quail and the hawk?
Yeah.
Why is half missing?
You come and get me after the whole flying half.
Right.
He's
gone
on the block and he said, you'll come and get me.
Right.
And then the whole really angry, this guy.
Yeah.
And now real fast.
Yeah.
Trying to
catch
the whale.
Yeah.
Sorry, I listened to this in Vietnamese. I'm trying to reverse it to you.
Please don't apologize. Yeah, we understand.
And then a little whale was on the rock, quickly high under the rock.
Yeah.
And then a very angry hawk landed on the rock and he died.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he died right there. And the story trying to say that we sometimes we do like somebody create anger and then we use our anger.
Right, so you're the one. You're
not part of the story.
Right. Yeah. So that's, well, it sounds very much like the same story, right? I'm sure Thich Nhat Hanh's very familiar with the Pali Suttas, so I'm sure there's probably a version of this in the Chinese, but he also would have learned it from the Pali as well. Let's move on to another sutta. This is an interesting one, another little parable. Mendicants, in the Himalayas, there are regions that are rugged and impassable. In some such regions, neither monkeys nor humans can go, while in others, monkeys can go, but not humans. There are also level, pleasant places where both monkeys and humans can go. There, hunters lay snares of tar on the monkey trails to catch the monkeys. The monkeys who are not foolhardy and reckless see the tar and avoid it from afar, but a foolish and reckless monkey goes up to the tar and grabs it with a hand. He gets stuck there. Thinking to free his hand, he grabs it with the other hand. Gets stuck there. Thinking to free his hand, he grabs it with his foot. He gets stuck there. Thinking to free both hands and foot, he grabs it with his other foot. Gets stuck there. Thinking to free both hands and feet, he grabs it with his snout. He gets stuck there. And so the monkey, trapped at 5 points, just lies there screeching. He'd meet with tragedy and disaster. The hunter can do what he wants with him. The hunter having speared him and pried him off that banana tree, goes wherever he wants. Sorry, I'm hesitating because I've just retranslated this. And so this is what happens when you roam out of your territory into the domain of others. So then the rest of it is then the same. Okay, so this particular story is kind of interesting for a few different reasons. Obviously, this is very similar to stories you might be familiar with of Brer Rabbit and the Tar Baby, right? Yes? No Brer Rabbit and the Tar Baby? Famous folk tale, originally was probably African in origin, brought to America by the slaves and then told and retold, collected in folklore stories, so found widely distributed in Africa, but versions of it found all over the place. There's a version told in the Philippines and throughout India and so on. Whether these are all from the same root or whether they just had similar experiences is hard to say. That's one for the folklore experts. So do you know how they tell that? Do you know how they tell that, by the way? Do you know how they know whether something's universal or something's originated in different places? No? Does anyone know the method? Okay. How you do it is you have to identify, if you want to do it properly, you have to identify the same story in multiple different places, right? So let's say you identify the same story maybe somewhere in Eastern India and then in Western India and then the Middle East and then, say, in the Lebanon and then, say, Greece or something. And then you have to look at the changes in the story. And if you see that there are consistent changes in that story across that way, then that's telling you about the journey that the story has taken. But if you see, like, arbitrary differences between things in different places, then you can't make that connection. It doesn't mean that they're not disseminated, but it means that you can't show that it's disseminated. So that's the meaning, that's the method that folklorists use to try to establish these things. Anyway, so this particular one, very widespread. The tar, by the way, is not fossil fuel tar that we use for bitumen. The tar is produced from tree sap. According to the commentary, it's produced from a banyan tree. And so the banyan tree sap is still used as an Ayurvedic ingredient in India today. The story seems to have had some minor textual corruption, and there's a few details in it that are quite difficult to actually determine exactly. But based on the research that I did earlier this week, I think that the thing that the monkey gets attached to is actually a banana tree. And so one of the things that the story is kind of missing is, like, why is the monkey doing this, right? Like, why is the monkey going up and putting their hand on the tar, and what is the tar attached to? Well, it was a banana tree. And I think that there's a bit of textual corruption that's made, and it's also like the reason why it's corruption is because the word for the banana tree is an extremely obscure word for an obscure banana, right? So this isn't an ordinary banana. This is a Himalayan banana. Right, known these days as the Indian dwarf banana, and there's one which is only found in Arunachal Pradesh, and that's what I think that this was talking about, and I think it got confused because it was such an obscure term, but I think that the tar trap was laid on a banana tree. That's why the monkey was going up and grabbing it, and that's what he had to get freed from. Anyway. So, yes, the poor old monkey. Oh, my goodness. Right? I'm sorry. That was probably a bit traumatizing. Like, the hawk one is kind of, yay, go hawk, go quail. And the poor monkey, it is a bit traumatizing. Oh, sorry about that. Any questions? Yeah.
What's the Brer Rabbit?
Brer Rabbit, yeah. Basically, it's the same story, but yeah, they make up a little mannequin like a scarecrow, and they put tar on it, and you get stuck to it. Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah, so the 5 points is the 5 senses. Yeah. All right.
How the monkey kind of like went and got attached. Right. Does it show that we also get sucked through our senses to, how should I phrase it, yeah, like the craving would penetrate through,
right,
all the 5 senses.
Right, yeah, so the craving, so the word for the tar is the lepa or the stickiness, which is also a word in Pali for craving itself. So it's that stickiness that gets us stuck and gets us attached to things. Yeah. Yeah.
Why is that a reference to central desire for the sixth sense, mind?
Because this is talking about, like, the metaphor is talking about sense restraint. So it's talking about getting distracted into the senses as opposed to doing the meditation. Yeah. So this relates, if you remember, like before the talk, I talked about the Vinaya Loke Abhijja Domana Sangha, the removing covetousness and displeasure for the world. So so that's what this is also is referring to, essentially, is its ability to not get stuck on those things that we desire, and then that leads to a certain calmness of mind, which is a precondition for doing mindfulness meditation. Yeah. So it's not talking about like complete detachment or anything like that, but it's just talking about like not getting, you know, overwhelmed and not getting caught up in things. Yeah.
Just an odd thought. Would this 5 things also refer to the 5 makars of Tantra?
No, unlikely. Yeah, Tantra is much later, but also the sutra is quite explicit about what it refers to. Like it says, this is the 5 senses. Yeah. So generally speaking, you find in the suttas and things like this that the meaning is explained in the sutra itself. Obviously, there are cases where it's ambiguous, but in this particular case, it's pretty straightforward. All right. So how are we going for time? I might skip over that one. There's a nice one about the cooking curry. But I don't know if any people haven't had dinner, then that might make them a bit hungry. But this is one of my favourite ones, so this is quite fun. This is number 47.19. And I actually just did a little bit of research on this one today. At one time, the Buddha was staying in the land of the Sumbhas, near the town of the Sumbhas called Sedaka. There the Buddha addressed the mendicants. At one time, mendicants, a pole acrobat of the corpse workers, set up a bamboo pole of his tribe and said to his apprentice, Medikatalika, come now, dear Medikatalika, climb up the bamboo pole and stand above my shoulders. Yes, tutor, she replied. She climbed up the bamboo pole and stood above her tutor's shoulders. Then the pole acrobat of the corpse worker said to Medhikatalika, "You look after me, dear Medhikatalika, and I'll look after you. That's how guarding and looking after each other will display our skill, collect our fee, and get down safely from the bamboo pole." When he said this, Medhikatalika said to a teacher, "That's not how it is, tutor. You should look after yourself, and I'll look after myself. That's how guarding and looking after ourselves will display our skill, collect our fee, and get down safely from the bamboo pole." "That's the way," said the Buddha. "It's just as Medhikatalika said to her tutor, thinking I'll look after myself, you should cultivate mindfulness meditation. Thinking I'll look after others, you should cultivate mindfulness meditation. Looking after yourself, you look after others. And looking after others, you look after yourself. And how do you look after others? By looking after yourself, by development, cultivation, and practice of meditation. And how do you look after yourself? By looking after others, by acceptance, harmlessness, love, and sympathy. Thinking I'll look after myself, you should cultivate mindfulness meditation. Thinking I'll look after others, you should cultivate mindfulness meditation. Looking after yourself, you look after others, and looking after others, you look after yourself. So a very nice little discourse there, and very nice message there. A number of interesting features about this discourse. One is that it doesn't actually have the formula for the four satipatthanas. Maybe it's just been abbreviated out, but it's unusual that it's not mentioned there at all. But let's have a bit of a look at the background and what's happening with these pole acrobats. Okay, let me break this down a little bit. So first of all, the land of the Sumbhas. Where is the land of the Sumbhas? Anybody know? No, nobody knows. But we suspect that it is, there's a town in Odisha. I can't remember the name of the town now, but it's what we think it is. I can't remember. I'd have to look it up. But anyway, so we think it's in Odisha, which is towards the southeast of where the Buddha normally taught, towards the Bay of Bengal. Okay, this is an important little detail. So if that identification is correct, this would be towards the easternmost that the Buddha traveled in his journeys. Okay, the Sumbha, the Sumbhas, and the town called Sedika. And it's only found in this text and the next, I think. I think only found in these two places. All right. So that's number one. Second thing is the corpse workers. Okay. So I've translated it as corpse workers. The Pali here is Chandala. Okay. So Chandala are one of the outcast tribes in India, and one of the most despised of the tribes in India. Now, the origins of castes and different peoples in India is very ancient and very hard to discern. But in my view, it's likely that these were originally tribal people who were excluded from the Vedic culture when the Vedic culture was introduced, and who found work as corpse workers. Like, they were often associated with like looking after charnel grounds, looking after cemeteries and these kinds of things, and as such were regarded as being highly inauspicious. All right. Okay, so a pole acrobat. What are these pole acrobats doing? Okay, so first of all, this is the oldest mention of pole dancing in the world. Okay, so I just want to say that Buddhism often doesn't get the recognition for the broader cultural contributions, okay, that we have made. Okay, so this pole acrobat of the corpse workers. Curious, isn't it? Right? What exactly is going on here? What exactly are they doing? The bamboo pole of his tribe, like the way that it's phrased, sounds like this is a skill or a sport, perhaps a ritual or something like that, which is associated with their own particular tribe. Now, in modern India, this is called Mallakhamba. Mallakhamba is a sport where you climb up poles and do all these kind of acrobatics and so on. It was an Olympic sport for 1 year, probably got dropped because nobody else could do it. And still quite widely practiced. Now, what I found just today was fascinating to me, because there's actually an old representation of this in an old pottery from a town or an area called Chandraketugar. So Chandraketugar is in West Bengal, which is not too far away from where Sumba is, we think. Like, it's further east, a few hundred kilometers further east, but same kind of general region near the Bay of Bengal. So, and this is from about 200 BC. So not too distant in time and place from actually where this sutta was depicted, right? Roughly kind of similar general region and time. And we have a beautiful depiction of this, in fact, performance, this kind of performance. The pottery from there is stunning and the artwork is really stunning. And unfortunately, the site has been largely despoiled and stuff has been nicked and taken to various private collections and museums and so on. So we don't know a lot of the provenance of things, but apparently this is about 2nd century BC. So what we see in this is the pole is set up, is in a T-shaped pole, okay? And there are three acrobats. So in this sutta, there are only two acrobats, but in the pottery, there are three acrobats. One is holding the pole, right? Crouching down, holding the pole up, which is up in a T, and then there are two acrobats doing their performances, one on either bar of the T. Yeah, amazing, right? And so of those two acrobats, one is male and one is female. And around them is a crowd, again, men and women in the crowd, who are obviously looking pretty astonished at what's going on, right? So obviously this is a highly skilled performance. And, you know, you can clearly see that there is a link to what is going on here in this particular sutta. So that's Chandra Ketugar, if you're interested to check out if I have a moment, I'll find the... So Venerable Pusana has posted the official site for the sport of Mallakhamba in India, if anyone feels like taking it up. Okay, so this gives us a few hints as to what's going on here as well. So one thing is that the name Medha Katalika is feminine, and the commentary explains, no, it was actually a bloke, which I always found very unpersuasive, so I translated it as that she's a woman. But interesting that in the pottery, clearly that there were women doing this, and there's both a man and a woman who's doing it. So clearly it is likely that, in fact, it was, you know, and because she's, like, climbing up above, this is what you normally do in acrobatics and so on, like the one down, man's down below holding up the woman who's above. So that's most likely is what's happening. Why are the corpse workers doing this? This is very interesting and very curious. So there's a few scattered references in the Pali texts to this kind of thing. A couple of references in the suttas, one in the Jatakas, and so on and so forth. What I think is happening, without going into too much detail, but what I think is happening is that these are tribal people whose livelihood and ability to make their way and so on has been destroyed or being affected, and who are doing a street performance for entertainment. A bit like when you go down to Circular Quay and you see some of the Aboriginal folks down there playing some didgeridoo, doing some dances and so on, and using their traditional performances as a display and as a performance for passers-by. I think this is the same thing that we're seeing here 2,500 years ago, which itself I think is pretty remarkable. Again, I won't go into too much detail with that, but that's why I think that this is the corpse workers who were doing this, that they were putting on this performance. Also remarkable that the Buddha was using the Chandala woman as the source of wisdom, right? I mean, it's literally the lowest person in the society, the most despised outcast clan, and the Buddha is saying, oh, no, she's the one who has the wisdom. We should be listening to her. That's pretty remarkable. So this is a very, to my mind, it was a really nice little sutta, a really nice little parable, and obviously the message of it is so important because often this is seen as being a dichotomy. You meditate or meditating is selfish because you're just looking after yourself, blah, 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 blah. and you should be serving and should be helping people. And the Buddha is saying that these things help each other. By looking after yourself, you're looking after others. By looking after others, you're looking after yourself. But if you can't have that inner grounding on your own mindfulness and self-awareness, your ability to help others is going to be deeply compromised. This is what tends to happen. You either trying to help others and you get burned out, or else you're helping others. But when you're helping others, you're actually just projecting your own things on them and doing like what is actually serving you, all of this stuff. So it can get very messed up. But if you have that inner confidence and sense of balance, like our wonderful acrobats up on their pole, then you can help yourself and help others. That's the balancing act of mindfulness. So any thoughts or questions on that one? Yeah? Oh, right, like if you, that's right, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's actually a good one, right? Right, yeah, and yeah. Sorry, Vincent, Kat?
There's a mention of Venerable Pindola Bharadwaja. Did he do something like this?
Oh, Pindola Bharadwaja, didn't he like climb up a pole or something like that? I think he climbed up a pole, yeah. Probably something similar. I have to just double check that one. Yeah, my main memory of that is from the Monkey Magic TV show, where they did the Monkey Magic TV show, where they like Tripitaka and met this Taoist sage, and they did this competition. They each had to climb up poles and see how long they could meditate for on top of the pole. So then they use their psychic powers to create a march fly and go and send it to buzz around the other one's ears. I don't know if that's really the purpose of meditation, but it's about the journey, isn't it?
I was just going to say, I remember many years ago there were comments about how like Theravada monastic tends to focus on their own attainment and then Mahayana tends to want to help other people. But kind of listening to the sutta, it just sounded like, you know, there isn't kind of like one better than the other. It's kind of that.
Right.
They were just looking at it from like, you know, like one of this position in,
right,
in a way.
Yeah.
I wonder whether another aspect of the parable is, this parable is one of the situations where the student corrects the master.
Right.
The master. The
right. Student. Right. The student's also correcting the master, yeah. Right?
And
that
the
another, another.
And the master joins them.
Right. Yeah, also another really important thing, that there's not this kind of, you know, absolute hierarchy, I have to say it and you have to do what's right. But yeah, they, and the voice, I'm not sure if I captured it exactly, but the voice that she speaks in that, she uses the future tense in Pali, which is quite an emphatic sense. No, it shall not be like that. Right? She's not saying, oh, maybe it could be another way. She's saying, no, it shall not be like that. Yeah, she's quite definitive about that.
Can I interject, please?
Yes.
I understand how you made a very interesting point about how the Buddha was actually looking for wisdom from someone who was associated with the lower castes.
Right.
He did it on purpose because, I mean, I gather because he was trying to break down the caste barriers that were prevalent
right
at the time. And he understood the egalitarianism of all beings, and of all consciousness.
Right.
And this was probably a way of doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. So, sorry, I'm just looking for the image bar. Yes, that's right. So he's doing that, but he's doing it. He's doing it. He's breaking down the car. He's not doing it overtly, right? He's doing it through storytelling. Yeah. So he's doing it quite subtle. Yeah.
So one day when you mentioned corps workers,
yes,
were they the ancient version of undertakers?
Not really. I mean, in a sense, yes. But I mean, an undertaker is a kind of a middle class profession, right? We regarded that. So there, they would have been really regarded as being quite, you know, they would have lived outside the city in the charnel ground. One of the stories, it's a similar one like this. They set up and they do some performance on the outside of the city and so on. But two Brahmin ladies walk past them and then they see them and spit on the ground and avert their eyes and say, oh, now we've been cursed because their eyes have even fallen on the sight of these chandalas. Yeah?
They still exist in Varanasi, same caste, same. Chandals exist today.
Still
exist. They are the ones that burn the bodies.
They burn the bodies, so they're still doing that, right?
Right now.
Yeah.
As of today.
Yeah. So. Unfortunately, I mean, India has tried to undo the caste system, but yeah, it's not easy. Yeah. Okay, so moving on. Okay, let's do one more before wrapping up. And this one concerns the finest lady in the land. This is Sanyutta 47.20, the Janapada Kalyani. So I have heard it. One time the Buddha was staying in the land of the Sumbas near the sound of the Sumbas called Sedika. There the Buddha addressed the mendicants. Mendicants, venerable sir, they replied, the Buddha said this. Mendicants, suppose that on hearing the finest lady in the land, a large crowd would gather and the finest lady in the land would dance and sing in a most thrilling way. I mean, it's curious that there's only like literally two suttas set in this place and both of them are about performance, okay? Most thrilling way on hearing, and then even more, they would hear the finest lady in the land is singing and dancing. The finest lady in the land is singing and dancing, then an even larger crowd would gather. Then a person would come along who wants to live and doesn't want to die, who wants to be happy and recoils from pain. They'd say to him, worthy man, here is a bowl filled to the brim with oil. You must carry it in between this large crowd and the finest lady in the land, when a man with a drawn sword will follow right behind you. And wherever you spill even a drop, he'll chop off your head right there. What do you think, mendicants? Would that person lose focus on that bowl? Would they get distracted outside? No, sir. Well, I've made up this simile to make a point, and this is what it means. A bowl of oil filled to the brim is a term for mindfulness of the body. So you should train like this. We'll develop mindfulness of the body. We'll cultivate it, make it our vehicle and our basis, keep it up, consolidate it, and properly implement it. That's how you should train. And once again, the Buddha doesn't actually mention the four satipatthanas in this sutta. It's a high bar, right? It does sound very stressful, yeah? So once again, this particular sutta, the translation has, I think, unfortunately, been in the past been a little bit sexist, okay, because we have this phrase, the Janapada Kalyani, usually translated as the most beautiful woman in the land, right? I find that translation a little bit sexist. Why? Because you can see here that she's not just known for her beauty, she's also known because she's a performer. She's a skilled dancer, she's a star. Right, she's not just a model, she's a star. And the word Kalyana, actually, in Pali, most of the time means good. It means morally good. Right? And whereas the word for beauty is Vanna, it's a different word altogether. So clearly it implies that she's beautiful, but she's not just the most beautiful lady in the land. So that's why I've translated as the finest lady in the land. Okay, and... okay, this whole simile, you can imagine, right? There's a whole big crowd, right? There's a singer on the stage, a performer on the stage, everyone's, and normally you have like fences and I mean, it's a pretty tense situation. Again, to me, it's quite remarkable that you see that same tense situation that you would see at any concert or performance today, you see there as well, right? Jostling crowd, people back and forth and so on. Sorry?
I said Bihar Got Talent.
Bihar Got Talent. Okay. Thank you. Right? That was going on right in those days. Yeah. And then that whole simile, right? Holding the bowl full of oil, each step behind you, ready to go. I'm not. Right? And so this, remember from in before the meditation, I talked about atapia, being ardent, being energetic. Yeah? So this is what this particular one is about, yeah? Being keen, not letting a single drop go. And so even though, yes, of course, we want to be balanced and we want to keep that sense of being fully relaxed, but at the same time, that relaxed is not lazy, it's not careless. It comes with that absolute sense of precision. And you can see that people who are very skilled develop that, like people say ballerinas, for example, right? Have that ability to have that incredible balance as well as that incredible strength, or acrobats I've just been talking about. So that is that level of detail and care and attention that we bring to mindfulness.
Can I just test my understanding of the simile? I don't think I get it.
About the what?
The simile.
The simile. Yeah.
Is it don't lose mindfulness while meditating?
Yep.
Or don't lose mindfulness in life?
Both. Yeah. Okay. So the question is, does it mean don't need mindfulness in meditating, don't lose mindfulness in life? Look, start out, well, obviously we do the best that we can, right? But the practice of Satipatthana is primarily talking about meditation. Okay, that's the main focus. But also, mindfulness applies everywhere. So we try to do the best we can. But this is also what Sampajanya is. So I mentioned this also before the talk, Sampajanya. Sampajanya understands context. So the detail and clarity, the precision with which you bear your mindfulness in the meditation is much more refined than it is if you're walking down the street. Right? But you still have some mindfulness walking down the street. You don't just wander out in front of a bus, for example, right? So you have some mindfulness. So this is your Sampajanya understands how to apply the mindfulness in different situations. Okay? So don't despair.
This is the person with the sword symbolizing. What's the name?
Well, I guess ultimately the threat is that you don't get enlightened and therefore you die. Get stuck in samsara, right? Yeah. Keep on going round and round, yeah.
Why did the Buddha particularly think that mindfulness of the body, like not the breath?
Well, mindfulness of the body includes the breath, right? Mindfulness of the breath is like part breath is part of the body, right? Yeah.
Somebody I know who has clear comprehension.
That's clear comprehension is one of the translations of Sampajanya, yeah. Yeah. But yeah. Okay, we good? I think we should probably wrap up about now, getting up to time's getting on. Thanks everybody for your attention. Thanks for spending some time to meditate and practice Dhamma and to be together. It's awesome. Amazing. So I'm honored that to be able to come and share the Dhamma with you today. Thanks to all of you who have joined us from online as well. We'll be back here again next week and in Parramatta as well. And as a warning for you all, next week is Dark Week. Yeah, pretty sure next week is Dark Week, right? The Friday surrounding First Tuesday. So next First Tuesday is not next week, is it? I thought it was. It's another one. Okay, ignore me. Dark Week's the one after.
Do you want it to be the first Friday?
No. It's the Friday following the First Tuesday. Hang on. Oh, the 1st of April is Wednesday. Sorry, my mistake. 1st of April is Wednesday. Okay, Dark Week is the following week. Ignore me.
So we're
coming
Friday.
Come on, I think good. Sorry? As far as I know, yeah, Good Friday should still be on. Yeah. So yes, so Good Friday is still on.
That sounds good to me.
That is pretty dark though. I mean, I was in a Catholic family. My dad was always like, I don't know if we're supposed to, are we supposed to celebrate Good Friday or or we're not quite sure exactly how we're supposed to feel about that. Anyway, so it's not Dark Week next week. I mean, it might be dark, but that's not the theme of the thing. But anyway, thank you, everybody, and we will see you again next week, hopefully. Yes, so Tuesdays at Parramatta at the 5 Library Hub in Parramatta Square, 5 Parramatta Square, that's at 6 o'clock, and here at 7 in Crow's Nest on the, yeah, I think that's it for now. Anything else needs to be announced? Venerable Pasana is leading the meditation session for the Metta Center next Wednesday. So that's in Parramatta at the Western Sydney Uni at 7 p.m. And you can join that one online. So check the Metta Center website for that. Yeah. Thanks, Sinsin. What's next Sunday? Okay, good. Thank you. Excellent. Thank you for mentioning that. So daylight saving in Sydney apparently ends this Sunday.
No,
not this Sunday. Easter Sunday.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, fine. Just an advance warning then for folks overseas. For folks overseas, daylight saving will end on Sydney on Easter Sunday. So following that, then the time for you internationally is going to change. So check that. Thanks for mentioning that. Okay. Thanks, everybody. Okay, cheers. Bye-bye.